This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
we are looking forward to a situation whereby the public will further assist wherever the remnants of the Boko Haram terrorists are. They inform the security agencies so that they will be arrested and prosecuted.
That's Acting Army Spokesman Brigadier General Sani Kukasheka Osman of Nigeria speaking on progress against Boko Haram. Details next.
Also, U.S. President-elect Donald Trump is scheduled to meet Republic of Congo President Denis Sassou Nguesso today.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Republic of Congo President Denis Sassou Nguesso plans to meet with U.S. President-elect Donald Trump today. In a tweet, Mr. Sassou's spokesman said the two will talk about Libya and other pressing issues in Africa. President Sassou chairs the African Union's Committee on Libya. President-elect Trump is vacationing in Florida this week, and no other details about the meeting with President Sassou have been released.
The Nigerian army says it has delivered a crushing blow to the Boko Haram terrorist organization by driving the militants out of their hideout in the Sambisa forest. In a goodwill message to the troops involved in Operation Lafiadol, President Muhammadu Buhari praised their determination, courage, and resilience for finally entering and crushing the remnants of the insurgents. The president urged the army to maintain the tempo until the Boko Haram insurgents are brought to justice and all of the kidnapped Chibok girls are freed. Acting Army spokesman Brigadier General Sani Kukasheka Osman says morale is high among the troops.
So far, so good. And we have done so well to the point that recently we embark on our final onslaught on the vestiges of Boko Haram terrorists inside the Sambisa forest. And last week, we were able to capture their stronghold, otherwise known as Farisu, specifically Camp Zero, where the hills were inside the forest. We have cleared it and we have captured it to the point that they are no longer having any base wherever anymore. Suffice to also mention that last week we told the public to be more security conscious and more vigilant, in the sense that the Boko Haram terrorists are in disarray, so they are scattering within the country and even across the borders. And luckily enough and thankfully too, people have risen to the occasion to the point that arrests have started to be made. And apart from that also, the roads that were closed for close to 3 to 4 years, for instance, the road that leads from Maiduguri through Gubbio to Damasak, and the one from Maiduguri through Bongono to Baga, were reopened on Christmas Eve, and quite a number of commuters have started flying the road. And one good thing about it also, over 3,000 inhabitants of Damasak town returned from across the border, and some of them from the internally displaced camp. It's a sign of confidence. And on the part of the military, for the first time, the hierarchy of the army, led by the Chief of Army Staff, they went all over our military locations in the Northeast to celebrate Christmas and New Year with the troops, and it was really, really good. And we are looking forward to a situation whereby the public will further assist wherever the remnants of the Boko Haram terrorists are. They inform the security agencies so that they will be arrested and prosecuted. And we see within the year 2017, we start rotating our troops fully.
Brigadier General, soon after taking office, President Buhari challenged the military to defeat Boko Haram. Would you say that the military has accomplished this task?
Yeah, if you look at it, we have been tasked and we have done and will continue to do the best we could to ensure that the security challenges have been nipped in the bud. And typically, the issue of Boko Haram terrorists has decisively been dealt with, that they can no longer constitute the threat they used to constitute before. Whereas you are quite aware, the president was quite pleased with the unprecedented feat of the capture of Camp Zero and clearing all the vestiges of Boko Haram terrorists, to the point that he sent us a goodwill message, which is quite encouraging, and we are really proud of it, and we will continue to remain loyal and continue to do the best we could.
Brigadier General, so nice to talk with you again, and the best of the new year.
Thank you so much. I wish you the same, too.
That's Acting Nigerian Army Spokesman Brigadier General Sani Kukoshake Osman. He was speaking with VOA's Jane Barty from Abuja.
2016 was predicted to be a tough year for African economies, and it delivered. Heavyweights Nigeria and South Africa slumped into recessions, and others also felt the burn of dipping global commodity prices. Economists predict that 2017 will see some recovery, but add that many African nations need to get serious about diversifying their economies to protect against future shocks. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
African economies showed two divergent trends, with the traditional leaders faltering amid a storm of falling commodity prices, unpredictable and destructive weather like droughts and floods across large swaths of the continent, and slow economic growth in China, a major investor and trading partner.
So this year you've seen kind of the two Africans, the commodity exporters going through tough times, while the non-commodity exporters being a bit more resilient.
That's Nigerian economist Nonso Obakili, who researches Nigerian and sub-Saharan economic trends for Economic Research Southern Africa. He says 2016 was hard on African commodity giants as oil prices fell to lows not seen since the global financial crisis of 2008. Resource-rich economies like Nigeria, Angola, and Mozambique foundered. Nigeria battled its highest rate of inflation in 11 years. Politics also took their toll this past year, notably in South Africa, which has seen growing tensions over scandal-plagued President Jacob Zuma. The economy in the third quarter followed Zuma's descent in popularity, falling from 3.3% in the second quarter to 0.2% growth in the third quarter, according to the nation's statistics agency. Ghana's economic woes contributed to President John Dramani Mahama's defeat in December elections. He will be a one-term president. And falling commodity prices helped turn an election in the copper-rich nation of Zambia into a bitter contest, with the unsuccessful challenger running on a promise to fix the ailing economy. And there were some other surprises. Mozambique's parliament uncovered at least $1.4 billion in undisclosed government debt that the World Bank estimates halved the nation's economic growth rate and dropped foreign investment by about 17%. Meanwhile, what we think of as resource-poor nations, like Ethiopia and Rwanda, maintained higher growth rates, as high as an estimated 8% in agriculture-heavy Ethiopia, despite the nation's worst drought in decades, according to the World Bank. Martin Davis, Managing Director of Emerging Markets in Africa at Deloitte, says these successful African economies focus on expanding and diversifying their economies to attract foreign investment.
Kenya remains a regional hegemon. Tanzania is looking somewhat more competitive, largely because of political shift, and those, to an extent, reforms in Tanzania would set up Tanzania for better growth prospects going forward, more quality growth. I think that's very important. Ethiopia, strong sort of growth trajectory, despite the political fallout in the country taking place. So looking pretty strong. You have the agile economy like Rwanda doing incredibly well, small economy, increasingly looking towards services. The most, the easiest place to do business on the continent.
Major economic institutions predict some improvement in African economies in 2017, as global commodity prices are expected to rise. But Obakili says commodity exporters also need to improve their economic policies.
For Nigeria, Angola, Mozambique, getting the basics right in 2017 is very, very important. Getting back to a functional foreign exchange market is very important. Getting back to credit limits in terms of debt issues is very important. So if they get the basics right, then there's a potential that at least things will start to pick up in 2017.
But Davis is less optimistic.
I'm afraid now, from a policy perspective, it's all too late. And African economies, by and large, many of them remain price takers rather than price setters. And diversification is mentioned about the skills you have in your economy. Innovation, wealth creation, diversification ultimately follows people. If you're not creating domestic talent or at least attracting foreign talent into your country, you're effectively going nowhere.
Governments do appear to be listening. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari, for one, has repeatedly pledged over the past year to end the country's oil dependence. But diversification doesn't happen overnight. Economists say it may take a year or more for Nigeria to rebound from 2016, and as much as a generation to really break free from oil. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Somalia's National Intelligence and Security Agency says it has arrested the driver of a car loaded with deadly explosives this month near the Mogadishu seaport. The blast killed 20 people and wounded dozens of others when it exploded December 11th. Muhammad Ibrahim Hassan is accused of driving the vehicle from the Janali district to the port. Hassan is believed to be linked with Al-Shabaab militants in Mogadishu, which has seen a rise in terror attacks in the past weeks. The Al-Qaeda-affiliated group has vowed to disrupt the Somali elections taking place in January.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. President-elect Donald Trump is scheduled to meet Republic of Congo President Denis Sassou Nguesso today. And President Muhammadu Buhari has praised the Nigerian army for driving Boko Haram militants out of their hideout in the Sambisi forest. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
While much progress has been made in treating people infected with the AIDS virus, new research shows they face other health risks. A study says HIV-positive people have a much higher risk for heart attacks than those who are not infected. Researchers say the information could lead to better medical care for those living with HIV. Dr. Matthew Feinstein is a cardiovascular disease fellow at Northwestern University. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
HIV is an excellent example of really evolving epidemiology and competing risks for different sorts of diseases, especially in higher income countries and places where there's access to effective therapy for HIV, has really evolved from a generally fatal disease to what's really essentially a controllable chronic disease. But as we're learning, it's one marked by chronic inflammation and chronic immune activation. So the question is, if people are no longer dying as often from AIDS-related illnesses or opportunistic infections, what else is replacing them if there is still some morbidity associated with HIV?
So after your research, what did you find about the heart attack risk for those who are HIV positive?
The percent of deaths that are due to heart disease over the last 15 years, it's almost tripled in terms of the proportion of people with HIV who die from cardiovascular diseases. So that made us want to see how good the general models we use to estimate heart disease risk in the general population, how well do they work in HIV, thinking that they may not work that well because maybe their heart attack and stroke risk is significantly higher. We use the risk estimator, which is really used in the general population, and it's used in U.S. in cardiology clinics and actually in primary care clinics quite a bit to understand what are people's 10-year and lifetime risks for heart disease. So we used that and we applied it to this large cohort of HIV-infected individuals, and we ended up finding that the risk predictor was significantly underpredicting risk for heart attack in the HIV-infected people, and because their risk for heart attack are substantially higher than in the general population.
Is this the same for those who are on treatment as well as those who are not on treatment?
certainly being treated for HIV, it's obviously better than not being treated for HIV, but it is also better for heart disease risks. That said, there is still residual risk for heart attack and stroke, and actually for other heart-related morbidities and mortality causes such as heart failure. There is still that residual risk even when you're treated for HIV. And in fact, in this cohort, the vast majority of participants were taking antiretroviral therapy. They were all engaged in regular clinical care at HIV care sites. And despite that engagement in care, there was still this elevated risk for heart attack.
About a year or so ago, I remember doing an interview regarding HIV and lifespan, and they found that people who are HIV positive could have shorter lifespans because their immune system has been so active for so many years. Is that related to what you found? Because you did mention inflammation.
The short answer is yes. a little bit of a longer answer, really what we think is going on is that there's this chronic inflammation and immune activation in the setting of HIV. And even when the virus is undetectable in the blood, there's still this low-level viral replication in the tissues that drives global and even vascular, most likely, inflammation, immune activation. And why does that matter for this? That immune activation, that inflammation can lead to the development of plaques in the arteries, and those plaques can become unstable. When those plaques become unstable, they rupture, and that's a heart attack, that's a stroke.
And this doesn't matter what the person's age is or race or gender.
Certainly in the general population, the older you get, the higher your risk for heart attack or stroke. And certainly that's true in an absolute sense in HIV. If you're 70 years old and have HIV, your risk for heart attack is certainly higher than if you're 35 years old and you have HIV. That said, there is an accelerated risk. So there have been some really nice studies using imaging to evaluate atherosclerosis, the buildup of plaque in the arteries in the heart and near the heart. And they've seen that HIV-infected people tend to build up this plaque about 10 to 15 years earlier than uninfected people, even when they're well-treated.
So now that you have this information, can you make any recommendations, or do you need to do further study?
Certainly, we need to do a lot of further study. That's the first and most important point here, because what we found is that our existing risk estimators aren't that good, and that even when we tried adding some HIV-related variables in here, it didn't really improve how well we did at predicting someone's risk of heart attack or stroke. That said, the one thing we've found pretty consistently here is that there's under-prediction. What you can, I think, pretty safely say now is their risk for a heart attack or stroke in the next 10 years is at least 10%. It could be quite a bit higher, but it's at least that. Having a sense of what the risk for heart attack or stroke is really so important to figuring out how we best prevent and then ultimately treat them.
That's Dr. Matthew Feinstein, cardiovascular disease fellow at Northwestern University. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
A former graphic designer in South Africa has made a name for himself internationally for the knives he forges in Johannesburg. Andre van Stratoen clients around the world include professional hunters, fishermen, and survivalists. His knives are respected for their clean flowing lines, elegant curves, and interesting shapes. Experts also praise them for being razor sharp, extremely tough, and highly corrosion resistant. Darren Taylor reports in the second part of a series about some of South Africa's master crafters.
Andre van Straten sorts through raw steel in his workshop. He says his relationship with knives started when he was a toddler.
When I was a kid, I used to like climb up onto the table, pull the chair out, get into the knife drawer, and pull knives out and play with them and, you know, chuck them on the floor and stuff. I've always been fascinated by knives. I've just always had a connection to them.
Van Straten, in his early 40s, remembers the first knife he bought when he was 12. He describes it as a cheapie from a pawn shop.
An old Bowie knife, a Chinese piece of junk. I've still got it. It's in pieces, it's scratched, it's blunt, but I've still got what's left of it.
He made his first knife when he was 15 using his dad's tools and scrap steel. It was a dagger he copied from the cover of a fantasy novel. Decades of amateur knife making followed. Then, a few years ago, van Straten turned professional under the tutelage of an expert bladesmith. He buys high-quality stainless steel and grinds it into the various styles of knives he makes, from those used by hunters to skin animals, to the style that's his passion, tactical knives with serrated blades, like those used by Army Special Forces.
Like the kind of knife you could use in a wilderness situation or a survival situation, but also as a defensive tool and as a weapon.
Van Straten heat treats his knives in an electric furnace. Then he oils them and tempers the blades in an oven at 360 degrees Fahrenheit for 2 hours to make the steel ultra hard. He polishes the knives with a machine to a chrome finish.
And then for handle materials, natural wood, bone, horn, and then G10, which is layers of fabric impregnated with resin.
Van Straten says people think it's easy to make a knife. After all, it's just a handle and a blade. But he considers it to be an intricate art, and it's that complexity that excites him.
Designing a knife is very weird. It's an art of millimeters. You move a line a millimeter this way, a millimeter that way, changes the shape, changes the feel of the knife. And there are millions and millions and millions of configurations, and everyone is different. And it's just, you know, you just go, okay, well, what can I make next?
Van Straten sells his knives for an average of about $250. Many are attractive, the silver of the blades contrasting, for example, with an African hardwood handle that's almost purple in color. But he insists knives can't just be pretty ornaments.
I choose function over form, but again, you don't want a useful knife that's just butt ugly. That's also no good.
Van Straten holds a knife with a broad, jagged blade and a handle decorated with twisted green and black patterns. He says a friend and his son inspired him to make it.
They were carjacked, and the son was quite traumatized, and he had a thing for knives, and he only felt safe when he had a knife. So for his 13th birthday, I designed this knife, and I made it for him, and his name was Callum. So Callum Tactical Knife, so I called it the Caltac.
Security experts have taught Van Straten how to defend himself using a knife, but he says he never wants to use those skills.
If a guy pulls a knife and wants to fight me, I'm just going to run in the opposite direction. I'm not going to stand and trade blows, because people think, oh, you'll take a cut on your forearm. That thing will cut your arm. You'll never use it again. You know what I mean? You'll have... you'll see what work
is. As he prepares his workshop, Van Straten says he also crafts leather knife sheaths, but it's not his favorite part of his craft.
I don't like working with sharpened knives when I'm working with leather, because I'm quite clumsy and I can cut myself.
Man, that doesn't inspire confidence, man. You're a knife maker and you're telling me you're clumsy.
I am clumsy, but... So far, I've still got all my fingers. I do tend to cut them every now and then, but I haven't had any serious injuries so far, touch wood.
It's Van Straten's knives that are serious. Serious works of art, and recognized as such by customers all over the world. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhibi in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Modou will take a look at some of the top health stories of 2016. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.